This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning, I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Bahardin.
This is In Case You Missed It. This week we present to you a collection of stories from Asia Calling.
Let's start with the first two. Syrian refugees want to be recognized in South Korea. And in India, mining industries are killing migrant workers.
The war in Syria continues to cause tens of thousands of refugees to flee into Europe. But some who have escaped the fighting at home have made it all the way to South Korea. Jason Strother introduces us to one Syrian man who now calls South Korea home, though he is not sure for how much longer.
Jeju Island is best known as a honeymoon getaway for South Koreans. It's covered in black volcanic rocks that jet out into the sea. About 600,000 Koreans call the island home, and now that includes one man from Syria. His name is Ahmed Lababidi.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to see you. Assalamu alaikum. Where's a good place to talk?
We should find some coffee shop.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
It's a typically windy day here, so we go into a nearby cafe to have a chat. Lababidi is 22 years old. He wears glasses, is clean-shaven, and is growing his dark hair long. As the war back home engulfed his hometown, Aleppo, in 2012, his family escaped to Turkey. By the end of that year, he and his brother both obtained three-month-long business visas for South Korea. They said they were going to buy cars. Lababidi says he expected that he'd live in the capital, Seoul, but he changed his mind after a trip to Jeju.
I visit Seoul many times, but wherever I go there, I get sick, I get stressed, tired, so I just want to back.
After a few months living on the island, he went to immigration and applied for refugee status. But officials there told him that fleeing war is not grounds for asylum, only escaping persecution is. Lababidi repeats the conversation he had with the immigration agent to me.
I said, of course, government wants me. I know that. How did you know that? Give us proof and then we will give you a refugee. I said, how can I prove that? I have some activities on Facebook, anti-government, so they know my name.
Instead, they issued him a humanitarian visa, which allows him to stay in Korea, but as he explains, it's a lot different from refugee status.
No health care, no housing, no salary. They just say, you are not a refugee, we are just giving you this kind of humanitarian status.
Immigration won't say for how long or for how many times he can reapply for this visa. Lababidi is not alone. By the end of last year, around 850 other Syrians had applied for refugee status in South Korea, and only three have been granted it. I spoke with an official at immigration who says all applicants are treated fairly. While South Korea has a very generous resettlement program for North Korean refugees, some human rights advocates say there's a negative bias toward other types of refugees. The call to prayer rings out from Seoul's central mosque, the largest Islamic house of worship in the country. Chung Shin-young, an immigration lawyer, says Muslim asylum seekers are generally treated with suspicion in South Korea.
So basically, if you see Korea, it's a very homogeneous society. So it's really hard to accept diversity. But when it comes to other people, other nationalities, they come to Korea for seeking asylum. We don't really feel, you know, like they feel different feelings. It's different because they have different skin colors, different cultures. And so I think that's the one of the most important reasons that we don't really accept these different people.
Like in Europe or North America, many South Korean politicians, media, and law enforcement try to make the link between Syrian refugees and terrorism, Chung says. She gives me an example of what police reportedly told Muslim migrants in one city here.
These police go to approach it to Muslims and ask them to shave their
beard.
Beard, just to, you look like terrorists, you should you should shave your beard. That's what they say. And they go to Muslims' mosque to, you know, just search. Anyone looks like terrorists.
For Ahmed Labbabidi, life on Jeju Island has been pretty good, and he's made a lot of friends through his job waiting tables at a local Indian restaurant. But he says police did question him and every other Syrian in South Korea following the terrorist attacks in Paris last year.
Yeah, I feel bad, like, why they come to me. They think I'm terrorist, but I understand later that they have older. They don't know me.
Labbabidi says he's hopeful South Korean immigration will reconsider his refugee application. Another option is that if his parents, who are still in Turkey, get refugee status in Europe, he might go there. But he says he prefers to bring his family to Jeju Island.
It will be better. They can come here to visit Jeju. Whenever I go in Jeju, I think about them. They cannot see this kind of places. They cannot feel this kind of life here. So maybe.
For Asia Calling, I'm Jason Strother on Jeju Island, South Korea.
This is just one instance of a Syrian refugee seeking refuge in South Korea. A few months ago, there were reports that dozens of Syrians were living in an airport in South Korea hoping to gain refugee status. Now, the UNHCR office in Seoul plans to increase awareness of the refugee issue in the country as a result of this incident, but not much is known about the incident.
It seems that South Korea is using the humanitarian status to put the refugee applicants in limbo. Based on figures taken from 2010 to 2014, South Korea has granted refugee status to only 331 applicants out of over 9,000 asylum seekers. That's very low. But as much as I want to wholly criticize them, I feel like South Korea, or governments in general, are struggling with this crisis. They need to think of the welfare of the migrants coming in, but at the same time, they need to keep their own citizens happy. Such a difficult position to be in. In May, the Supreme Court of India ordered the Gujarat state government to pay $4,600 in compensation to the families of deceased workers. The workers, who are mostly from districts of Madhya Pradesh, died of silicosis, a lung disease caused by the inhalation of crystalline silica dust while working in the quartz mining industries of Gujarat. Hundreds of migrant workers died because of the disease, and their families have been fighting for the last 10 years for compensation. Shuryah Niazi has this report.
Hurabai is bedridden and very weak. She is suffering from silicosis. The disease has already claimed the lives of her husband, son, daughter-in-law, and other relatives.
I have lost many family members who went to work in Gujarat. Now I have been suffering from the disease for the last 3 years after working there too. I suffer from breathlessness and also joint pains, and I haven't received a single penny from anywhere.
Hundreds of families in the tribal-dominated areas of Jhabua, Dhar and Alirajpur districts in the state of Madhya Pradesh have also fallen victim to the deadly disease. Wasta Bhai lost 4 of his sons.
Four of my children got jobs in a factory in Gujarat. They used to crush stones at the plant and they all contracted silicosis while working there.
However, a recent judgment from the Supreme Court has brought new hope. It is believed the order to the Gujarat government to pay compensation will now also force the state government and the administration to take action against quartz factories which have been operating illegally and care little about their workers. Amulya Nidhi represents the local NGO Swasthya Adhikar Manch, which has been fighting for the workers' rights.
We have been waiting for this decision for the last decade. Now, we hope the state governments of Gujarat and Madhya Pradesh will implement it. The court has pointed out that the Gujarat state failed to protect the rights of poor migrant workers from Madhya Pradesh, as they didn't take any preventive measure, while the laborers worked in deplorable safety conditions and ultimately contracted silicosis.
Hundreds of people who worked in the 4 dozen quartz factories in Gujarat have lost their lives to silicosis upon returning home to Madhya Pradesh. and many more are bedridden after returning from work in the quartz factories. After it is mined, the factories are tasked with crushing the quartz, which is high in silica. But when the fine dust is inhaled, it can settle on the lungs and cause silicosis. Dr. Vikrant Bhuria is a doctor at a government hospital in Jhabua in Madhya Pradesh, explains.
During work, they inhale fine silica dust, and once the silica powder enters the lungs, it causes hardening of lung tissue. Slowly the powder hardens in the lungs, and the affected person suffers from breathlessness, fever, and cough. Within 2 weeks or 2 years, the person becomes very weak and loses appetite. As the lung damage increases, the person suffers from severe breathlessness and ultimately dies.
Over the past 10 years, almost 600 workers died from silicosis in Madhya Pradesh, according to a recent survey by the local organization Shilp Kendra. But when Asia Calling contacted factory owners in Gujarat, they declined to comment. In 2010, the National Human Rights Commission asked the Gujarat government to compensate the workers and their families, but they didn't receive anything. Amulya Nidhi says it has been tough to get the government to respond.
We have been trying hard to see the government take action against these factories. We wanted them to be closed so the innocent workers should not be trapped and exploited. Those working in these factories will die one day in the absence of proper safety measures.
It is hoped now that the new ruling by the Supreme Court might make the difference. For Asia Calling, this is Shura Niazi from Madhya Pradesh, India.
It's great that the Supreme Court has finally ruled in favor of the families of the deceased workers. Better late than never, I suppose. Though I don't know how much the compensation can actually placate their loss. It can actually be avoided if the employers follow proper safety procedures. But they didn't, and they won't. Because to them, these workers are dispensable, as long as they are able to maximize their profit.
You're absolutely right, Hanif. And you know what? There was a news report just a few days ago, and it stated that major global companies buying mineral mica from India, they've all vowed to increase inspections of their suppliers for child labor. You see, an investigation by the Thomson Reuters Foundation found that at least 7 children have been killed since June from mining of mica. But this could be just a fraction of the actual number of victims because many of the deaths, they go unreported. There really needs to be better regulation. After the break, we have more stories from Asia Calling.
All that in a minute.
I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is In Case You Missed It, I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
We continue our selection of stories from Asia Calling, and this time we are going to Kashmir. The Indian-administered region of Kashmir remains under a strict curfew following the killing of a popular militant leader last month. The 22-year-old is said to be responsible for introducing what many see as a new face of anti-Indian militancy in the dispute region. As Bismillah Gilani reports, the killing has set off a chain of massive protests and violent clashes with Indian forces, leaving dozens dead and scores wounded.
In Kashmir's southern district of Tral, more than 100,000 people have gathered for the funeral service of 22-year-old Burhan Wani. A popular militant commander, Wani was killed along with his two associates in what the army claims was a gunfight between them and the militants. But locals believe it was staged and describe the killings as extrajudicial. 40-year-old Abdul Hamid is among the mourners.
तीन नौजवान और जिसका खुलेआम और बड़ी ब्रूटली उसका कत्ल किया गया और इसके
खिलाफ है ब्रूटल किलिंग एंड देन दे पुट रिस्ट्रिक्शन सो दैट पीपल कांट कम आउट एंड प्रोटेस्ट अगेंस्ट दिस इनह्यूमन एक्ट दे आल्सो अरेस्टेड द एंटायर लीडरशिप इट इज टाइम द इंटरनेशनल कम्युनिटी वेक्स अप एंड आस्क्स इंडिया व्हाट काइंड ऑफ डेमोक्रेसी इट इज दैट हैज केप्ट अ टेरिटरी अंडर इलीगल ऑक्युपेशन फॉर सो लॉन्ग एंड इज ओप्रेसिंग इट्स पीपल.
Burhan Wani became a militant when he was just 17. According to his father, Muzaffar Wani, the final straw that pushed him over the edge came when his elder brother was mercilessly tortured by the army in his presence.
उन्होंने कुछ पिकनिक का थोड़ा बनाया था प्रोग्राम कुछ मीट वीट पकाया था थोड़ा तो फिर यहां
The two brothers had planned a picnic. They cooked some meat and took some other food and went to a nearby picnic spot. Suddenly some army soldiers came and picked them up. They were asking them to give them information about militants in the area. They hit the elder one with the butt of their rifle, breaking his skull, shoulder and nose. They also broke some of his teeth.
A few years later, the security forces killed his brother. But by then, Burhan had already become the poster boy of Kashmir's new militancy.
Indian army to already hamari dushman hai ye lekin police wale hamare apne hokar
Kashmir has been a disputed territory between India and Pakistan since the partition of the Indian subcontinent in 1947. Nearly 100,000 people have been killed in the region after an armed uprising against Indian rule broke out in the late 1980s. Although there is no evidence that Burhan has been involved in any killings, he did use social media as a weapon to issue warnings and threats to Indian security forces and to recruit local youth into militancy. Manmohan Khajuria is former Director General of Kashmir Police.
Burhan Wani is the man who changed the face of terrorism. Earlier, the terrorists would hide and the security forces and intelligence agencies had to look for them. But here's a man who dons an army fatigue with his nameplate and goes on the social media declaring who he is.
Burhan's daring attitude won him a huge following, with many of Kashmir's disgruntled youth deciding to join his ranks. Individuals like 19-year-old Zakir Rashid. His father Abdul Rashid told me he had sent his son out of the valley to study, but his militant experience left a deep mark on him. Then one day, Abdul Rashid found a letter in his son's room. "Don't search for me," it said. "I have chosen my path, and it's the right path." According to government sources, nearly 200 local militants have joined militancy in recent months, and all of them are young, educated, and from affluent families. While security forces view Burhan Wani's killing as a huge operational success, the aftermath has been nightmarish. Soon after his killing, massive protests broke out across the valley, with angry protesters attacking police stations, army camps, and government installations. Violent clashes between protesters and security forces have claimed at least 47 lives so far, while more than 3,000 people have sustained serious injuries. The government has also shut down telephone, mobile, and internet services in the region. The government says it's doing everything possible to ensure safety, but these claims are belied by the growing number of casualties. Mirwais Umar Farooq is chairman of the All Parties Hurriyat Conference, a coalition of more than a dozen separatist groups. He accuses the government forces of a killing spree.
What we are witnessing right now is the worst kind of state terrorism. There are no crowd control mechanisms in place. They could have used non-lethal weapons, but what we see is most of the people who have received bullet injuries have been shot either in the head or in the chest. There is a clear purpose of shooting to kill.
As the crisis in Kashmir deepens, India has rushed more forces to assist local authorities. Meanwhile, Pakistan has launched official protest with India over the recent killings. Human rights groups and the United Nations have also expressed concern over the situation. From New Delhi, this is Bismillah Gilani for Asia Calling.
I find this story fascinating as it tells the story from the perspective of the militants and how they are hailing Burhan Wani as a hero to their cause. That's the politics of Kashmir for you. At the end of the day, war is never a solution to anything.
The Kashmir conflict has been going on since the partition of India in 1947. The territorial dispute, it's a long and convoluted one, which really needs to be addressed ASAP. Both India and Pakistan have committed a lot of atrocities. Now, human rights groups have started a campaign against the excessive use of pellet guns, which have left people blind or injured. And a Pakistani lawyer has also created morphed images of celebrities showing what they would look like when injured by pellet guns. Now, the pictures are powerful, shocking, and haunting. And because the pictures feature celebrities looking like victims, people will actually stop to pay attention. And that's just how society is these days. We need something shocking like this for us to all sit up and pay attention.
In less than 3 decades, China has become the world's second largest economy. China has been pursuing an aggressive policy in this region in order to pull in resources to raise the living standards for its 1.4 billion people, declaring its right to huge maritime regions off its coasts. But in a landmark ruling, the Hague International Court recently dismissed China's claims unanimously. The fallout was discussed at a recent international symposium in Stockholm, Sweden. Rick Wasserman has more.
A free trade treaty, if it succeeds, will make these three countries become 1/4 of the world GDP.
The International Conference on Power Shifts and Peace in Southeast Asia saw three renowned academics square off, focusing on China's emergence as a regional power and the effects of a landmark international judicial ruling. July 12th was a historic day for the Philippines and its neighbors after years of dispute, said the Philippines Foreign Department spokesman.
The Philippines welcomes the issuance today, 12 July 2016, of the award by the Arbitral Tribunal constituted by the Permanent Court of Arbitration with regard to the South China Sea. The Philippines strongly affirms its respect for this milestone decision as an important contribution to ongoing efforts in addressing disputes in the South China Sea.
The Hague International Court threw out China's claims, even though China has refused to recognize the court's decision. For the Philippines, the decision concerns its fishing rights near the contested Panatag Islands. For several years, China has been busy constructing artificial islands in the maritime area, some with airstrips, while turning back fishing boats from the Philippines, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Japan. All part of China's superpower muscle flexing and greed for access to fish, oil, and sea lanes as far as 800 kilometers from its coast. This is the world's most important waterway.
The Chinese government claims a large chunk of the waters of South China Sea, and if China ends up controlling that area, the government vessels that carry natural resources to South Korea would be heavily affected. So that can be a sort of biggest concern.
That's Yong-Wook Ryu, an assistant professor at Australia's National University. He's referring to what China calls the nine-dash line, which it claims gives China the right to more than 80% of the entire South China Sea. But Ryu says he's not worried about China's regional domination.
Koreans are not as concerned about China dominating the region because the U.S. presence is still felt vividly throughout the region. So a lot of Koreans believe that USA will maintain its stronghold of the region.
Since the court's verdict, a legal pretext has been created for the United States, Japan, and Australia to conduct extensive multilateral navigation maneuvers to test China's claims in practice, albeit with the risk for military confrontation. Besides the Philippines and Korea being affected, Yong-Wook Ryu says that we must be wary of Japan, where nationalism is on the rise. The maritime dispute could trigger military action.
China looks at Japan and thinks, well, Japan is not as powerful as it used to be in the past, but Japan is more willing to use force now than before. The Japanese government wants to use greater force within the context of U.S.-Japan security alliance.
Kevin Clements is a professor of peace and conflict studies at University of Otago. He underlines that nationalism is becoming a growing and dangerous force in the region.
reemergence of nationalism in Northeast Asia, with Japan's swing to the right and desire to revisit the entire post-war agreement that between itself and the rest of the world. And I think that's an extremely worrying and dangerous sign, because it generates Chinese nationalism, and more importantly, activates Chinese memories of its humiliation under Japanese occupation in the 1930s.
The Chinese muscle flexing in the South China Sea has also riled the U.S., which must defend its regional partners. But they have to tread carefully, says Wang Yizhu, a professor of international politics at Beijing University.
You have to build up a comprehensive relationship with the United States. Sometimes some competition. Sometimes we also know win-win for both. Please give the patient. After all, this is a country with a 1/5 of the whole world population and still a long way to go.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has defended the maritime claims as a domestic issue in a quest to restore the nation to global greatness after long periods of humiliation by bigger powers. But an amicable solution with China, despite the Hague ruling, is the only way forward, says Kevin Clements.
Even with that kind of challenge, it seems to me really important that we try and devise both institutional mechanisms, regional mechanisms for ensuring that China has its interests acknowledged, that we begin figuring out ways in which it can play a positive role.
From Sweden, this is Rick Wasserman for Asia Calling.
This story is nicely simmering, and I expect a lot more conflict in the future. China is flexing its muscles and not giving in. It is trying to impose itself by bullying other countries around the region. I somehow feel that this goes beyond territorial dispute. China is trying to show its powers to the US, who is somehow looming in the background. I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again. This feels like a real-life Game of Thrones.
It really does, Hanif. It seems that the whole South China Sea dispute has become a display of power, with countries asserting their dominance over the territory. I fear that it may escalate if things are not handled delicately and soon. There's a Javanese proverb that says, a successful man must have a house, a horse, a wife, a dagger, and a songbird in a cage. And while the saying might sound fanciful, this belief is a big factor behind Indonesia's trade in caged birds. A trade that is pushing some endangered species to the brink of extinction.
At one time, there was thought to be just 6 Bali starlings left in the wild. For these small birds, their beauty has also been their curse.
All white with black tips of the wings, blue mask around the eye. The kids here, they say it's a Zorro mask. They have a Zorro, blue Zorro mask. It's a beautiful species, and this beauty made them very sought after by collectors.
That's Med Halloate, breeding and release manager at Bali's Begawan Foundation. He's responsible for the breeding and release of the critically endangered Bali starling. There are 60 birds under his care here at the Begawan Foundation.
When we see there is a good pair, when we see a good pair like that one, a lot of time together, and the male is always trying to seduce the females and getting her close by. When we see something like that, we move them to the honeymoon suite and they'll be housed on their own. They'll be given plenty of food and a nest, and they'll start a family.
These strategies are having great success in increasing the number of birds within the sanctuary. But even though the Bali starling is protected and capture and trade of the bird illegal, it remains under threat, with only 75 to 100 birds thought to exist in the wild now. The birds are being trapped and trafficked from the only places that they survive in nature. Med Halloate again.
They're still being trapped in Bali Barat National Park and in Nusa Penida because they fetch quite a high price. It's about $400 US each. The problem we have in right now is the young generation, not much old generation, but young generation. They see Bali Salin as equivalent of iPhone or iPad. It's nearly the same price.
Last year, the wildlife NGO Traffic counted 1,900 birds from 206 different species sold at Jakarta's three bird markets in the space of just 3 days. And not all of those sales are legal. In May this year, the NGO Scorpion found 1,500 birds and animals being sold at Mutalan Wildlife Market in Magelang, Central Java, without the necessary permits. Gunung Gia from Scorpion Foundation says it's not hard to find protected species being sold in wildlife markets across Indonesia.
It has been 1 year since we start monitoring wildlife markets in Indonesia, and we always find protected animals in the market, and the law enforcement are very slow against this illegal trafficking of the wildlife.
Despite the efforts of independent organisations to monitor wildlife markets, without the support of law enforcement authorities, they are unable to stop the illegal trade. This June, 25 different wildlife organisations from across Indonesia formed a coalition to urge the Indonesian government to do more to stop wildlife trafficking and illegal sales. They would like to see better enforcement of wildlife transportation permits and more effective policing where cases of illegal wildlife trade are reported.
We want the government to be more serious in facing wildlife crimes in Indonesia. We have forestry police rapid response unit, but they are very slow.
65 Bali starlings were released into the wild on Nusa Penida in the southeast of Bali in 2006-07. But after initial growth, their numbers dropped from 120 to 12 in the space of just 3 years.
The last audit we did, we found only 12 birds. And we found traps, we found ropes hanged on the trees, we found nest holes enlarged to fit hands, human hands, to get the birds.
Sanctuaries like the Begawan Foundation are successfully increasing the number of endangered birds in captivity. But as long as the birds continue to be captured, there aren't places where the birds can be released, safe in the knowledge that they will survive. Now the Begawan Foundation is trying to encourage school students and young people to care for and protect the rare bird.
It all depends on the young generation. We can do so much here, but if the young generation is not convinced that these birds need saving, we have done nothing.
For Asia Calling, this is Nicole Kirby in Bali.
I don't think that animals, especially the exotic ones, should be used as a commodity. And while enforcement should be tightened, the more important thing is education, which is what the powers that be in Indonesia are trying to do. Focus on the young, but never neglect the adults. They too need to be informed.
I completely agree, Hanif. Birds should be free to fly, not caged up and traded as a way for humans to make profit. Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio 68 High in Jakarta. This morning's show was produced by Hanif Baharudin and me, Cheryl Kaur. To listen to our podcast, head to bfm.my/icymi.
I hope it's been food for thought, and remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
This is, in case you missed it, BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.